provided, places for the gospel to be preached. They were no longer worshiping at the temple. If you were going to preach or going to teach, the synagogue was a place to do it. The Jews were always coming together there. And many times, as you read through the book of Acts, where do you find the apostles going to preach the gospel? Within the synagogue. All right, you found Jesus himself in the synagogue, reading of the scripture. Okay, now that's the Babylonian Empire. Well, who was next? Medes and the Persians. Okay, what did the Medes and the Persians bring to the table at the fullness of time? Unchangeable law. All right, how does that affect us as Christians? All right, God's law stands. Okay, the king and the, under the Medes and Persians, the king decreed something. The king himself could not change it. Jesus is king. He decrees the law. Guess what? It doesn't change, right? Okay, that's the Medes and the Persians. Who's next? The Greeks. All right, what did the Greeks bring to the table? Universal language. Okay, why was that important? Right. Okay. So wherever the gospel goes, whether it's in Asia, whether it's in Europe, wherever to the known world, wherever the gospel is going to go, they can communicate with one another. It had a lot to do with education under Alexander. Alexander, wherever he went, he spread Hellenistic Greek, and the language went with him. And so they educated. I mean, the Hebrews, they spoke two languages. Really, they spoke their native tongue. They would have spoken Greek, and so they were able to communicate with the gospel. All right, so you got the Babylonians, Medes and the Persians, Greece, and then in the times of these kings, who are these kings? It's Rome, right? What did Rome bring to the table? Roads and? All right. Universal peace, the citizenship, you're able to travel on these roads, so again, the gospel was able to travel very quickly. Commerce thrived under the Roman Empire, and so people are traveling, going back and forth, and so again, it contributed to the gospel spreading very quickly. Peace, now, you know, Rome was at war pretty much the entire time they were in power, but within their kingdom, there you could travel in relative safety. Okay, of course, you always had your outlaws, but relative safety as you travel those roads and on the sea. So you had all that fullness of time. All right, remember we talked a little bit about the Jews. What did the Jews themselves contribute to the fullness of time? What about the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and these different sects when it came to the Jews? How did the masses really feel about them? Why were they so accepting? Why did the multitudes flock to Jesus? What were the Pharisees known for? Legalism, right? The people could not live up to the standards of the Pharisees. Now, of course, the Pharisees put a strict twist on the law as far as the outward showings of it. Now, Jesus spoke of them saying that they spoke of God, but their heart was far from Him. Okay. The Sadducees, what were the Sadducees all about? They didn't believe in the resurrection. They were priestly caste. They were the head of the Sanhedrin. This was more, while they were religious to a degree, this was more of a political party. Okay, so they strove for power. And so the people, they were fed up with the Sadducees. They're fed up with the Pharisees. The Essenes, nobody really wanted anything to do with the Essenes. The Zealots were an even more strict part of the Pharisees. And so the people were just fed up with them. Okay, remember we talked about the different sects. They only made up about 11,000 folks out of 5 to 7 million within the Roman Empire. Okay, so people they're fed up with the Pharisees. They're fed up with the Sadducees. They want nothing to do with the other sect. So what are they ready for now? They're ready for the Christ. The fullness of time has come. It's now time for Jesus to come into the world. We talked about the church in prophecy, how it was in the mind of God. And then we began to talk about a little bit about the departure from the faith. Now, a big part within the Jewish part of Christendom was Judaizers. Okay, Judaizers came about. They began to teach that you could be a Christian, but you also had to adhere to the old law. Okay, and of course that's fallen away. That was what was happening in Galatia, wasn't it? Galatians chapter 2, Peter's eating with those that are, that are Gentiles. And Judaizing teachers, those from James, from Jerusalem came. And what did Peter do? Separated himself, didn't he? Snuck out the back door, so to speak. He didn't want to be seen because of these Judaizing teachers. He didn't want to be seen eating with the Gentiles. Okay? And Paul said, I withstood him to the face. That was sin. Now, that's what was happening there. They were teaching that you had to be circumcised to be a Christian. They were teaching, different aspects that you had to keep with the old law in order to be a Christian. They were trying to keep their old ways, but incorporate the new. And it wasn't working. And Paul told them that you can't do that. The Hebrews writer, while they were actually leaving Christianity altogether and going back to the old law. But you have the Judaizing teachers are starting to fall away, and there are several things that Paul wrote against that. It was prophesied, Jesus prophesied about this departure. Paul prophesied about this departure to Titus and Timothy. And I told you last week that we're going to begin looking at this departure in organization. All right? How is the church organizationally set up? Who's the head? That's Christ, right? The church of Christ, the church that belongs to Christ, does it have any earthly headquarters? No, where are our headquarters? In heaven, right? Okay, because Christ is the head. He sits at the right hand of God. He is the head of the kingdom. He is the king. Okay, what's next? He's under Christ. All right, the rest of us, obviously, but elders. Okay, and then deacons, and then there's the rest of it, right? Okay? That's how God set it up in the New Testament. Christ, elders to oversee the kingdom, okay? Deacons to help the elders in their work, right? That's how it's set up. And that's how it was for the first century and getting into the second century. But as you get into the second century, you begin to see a bit of a departure. All right. There are three words in the Greek that designate an elder. All right. And we translate them in this way: as overseer, a guardian, bishop, elder, presbyter, shepherd, and pastor. There are three words though that can be translated into those, or that seven words. Okay, what are they? Do you know? The first one is episkopos. Okay, episkopos is translated overseer, guardian, or bishop. Overseer, guardian, or bishop. That's episkopos. Okay? We find this word in Acts 20 and verse 17. That's why I had you turn to Acts chapter 20. Acts 20 and verse 17 says, "And from Miletus he sent to Ephesus and called the elders," or bishop in other translations, bishops, called the bishops of the church. Alright, you look at verse 28 and you see the same thing. "Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers," King James Version, "overseers there to feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood." Okay, so we see episkopos. We see presbyteros in 1 Peter chapter 5. That's the second word, presbyteros. 1 Peter chapter 5 verses 1 through 4. Is where this word is found. 1 Peter chapter 5. If I can get my fingers to work this morning. Beginning in verse 1, "The elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the suffering of Christ, and also partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly. Not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being ensamples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, you shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away." So this presbyteros, translated elder there in verse 1, presbyter in other places, Poimen is the third word. P-O-I-M-A-N in our English is how the Greek is spelled there. It's translated shepherd or pastor. Look at Ephesians 4 and verse 11. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11. And he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. Okay, pastors there is going to refer to elders. Okay, that is when the church was first established. Of course, not many folks, they didn't have the Bible. They weren't going to be Christians for very long, and so it was necessary for some to be designated as such by the gift of the Holy Spirit. And so we see that there, that translated there. Now, episkopos, presbyteros, poimen, did they designate different offices, or are they three words all for the same office? Same office, right? Same office. All right, but what happened here, as we're talking about the departure, this departure organization, is they began to make a distinction between these three terms. They began to have a distinction between a bishop and a presbyter and a pastor. Okay? What happened and what resulted was, a monarchical episcopate. In other words, when they made this distinction in terms, the bishop, began to reign supreme among them. Okay? You see this, and that's what Paul was writing about was talking about to the Ephesians, wasn't it? That there would be some among them. He's talking to the elders. There would be some among you. All right, grievous wolves will enter in among you. He's not talking about the church as a whole there, as we read of the Ephesian elders there in Acts chapter 20. He's talking to the eldership. Some among you, grievous wolves will enter in among you. And this is kind of what he's talking about here, that prophecy concerning this departure and organization. From about 100 to 150 A.D., the rule of one man over a congregation began as the distinction between these terms of bishop and presbyter arose. Now, of course, this is going to come up because of human pride. I mean, folks, you know, they're going to, and it's been happening since, really the beginning of time, you see it with Cain. I guarantee you that was a matter of pride. Look what I've done with my own hands. I've grown these vegetables. I'm going to offer them unto God, even though that's not what God requires. And you see that pride in man, from the beginning and going forward. And now we have this distinction that's coming up. And so you see the changes in the organization of the church as these ambitious men led off groups of their own disciples. Now, what we see in this departure organization is these local churches began to be ruled by one bishop with a group of presbyters and then deacons after him. A man by the name of Ignatius of Antioch. He was the champion of that departure. And one by one, churches adopted that practice, and Rome seems to have been one of the last to acquire a monarchical bishop, but they rose to power because of the political power that was centered in Rome at that time. And so, some local congregations, as they began to be ruled, by that bishop, the chairman of the elders, here's what happened really, is they would, let's look at it like this. There are some congregations let's take our eldership, for instance. Our eldership has what we, I don't know how to put it really. One of the elders is you, each month it changes. You contact them if there's something to be put on the agenda for their meeting. Okay? Elder of the month. Okay? That's a bad term. I don't like that, but I don't know how else to put it. All right, elder of the month. All right, but what happened there was rather than it rotating was the same elder He was the chairman, and that was it. Okay, and he began to be looked at as the head elder and the other elders under him. And there's where that distinction in terms came about. And as they placed that man as the head elder, and that distinction in terms came about, he began to make all the decisions without the eldership. And you see this growing congregation to congregation. And here's what would happen. Is this congregation would say, you know, there's not a church over in this little village out here, say 5 or 10 miles. So we'll send some folks out there and we'll establish a church there. Well, guess what? Who did that church answer to when this began to take place? The church that established. Or in other words, that one bishop that was head over here. And so you began to see this bishop would be head over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different congregations. And you see that continuing to grow for another 100 years, from 150 to 250 A.D., there was no authority above the monarchical bishop or the president, as it were, and he had no authority outside of his local congregation. But as that continued to grow, you see him taking over. As the leader of the congregation, as I said, he had that influence over congregations that started around them. And these congregations eventually came under his full authority. They evolved then into large territories. And then meetings began to be called among these different bishops. Okay, you would have the bishop over here in Antioch, and this bishop over here from Rome, and this one from Ephesus, and so forth and so on. And they would call these synods. They would call these meetings, these synods, after 150 A.D. And they would get together, and they would talk about the church. And eventually what happened among these synods is, well, we'll look to this one over here for power. The large city bishops, they had the greatest influence over these small congregation bishops. And those small congregation bishops began to disappear as they began to look to the larger city bishops for their rule. About 190, Victor of Rome, he claimed to be the universal bishop, meaning that he had authority over all churches. However, not many people really paid much attention to his claim. Not many folks paid him much attention at all. But the church at Rome, we see them at this time having an excellent reputation. Now, as they're drifting away as well, but they had a reputation among the other churches as being one of the most conservative congregations. And because Rome was looked to for political leadership, naturally it was looked to for spiritual leadership. And so by the end of the 200s, all large congregations had a bishop as its head with a group of elders under him. And each province looked to one bishop as greater than the rest with authority to call synods or councils. Now these three congregations rose to the top of power because of their apostolic, or their claimed apostolic origin. Now, from what I can tell in my studies, the church was already in Rome before an apostle ever made it there. Now, these three were Rome, Antioch, and Alexandria. And then Jerusalem came to power a little bit later. As a result of this hierarchy, of this distinction in terms and this development of the monarchical bishop, naturally what followed was the development of a priesthood. Now, what do we read in the New Testament concerning the priesthood of Christ and those that would be Christians? We all are. Okay? But what began to happen here was there began to be a gradual distinction between the members of the congregations and then those who would serve as ministers. And we look in the New Testament, there's no such distinction. You look at Paul and his missionary journeys and as he goes around with Silas and with Barnabas, and how they were regarded. They made no distinction, even though they were preaching the gospel and men attempted to fall down and worship them at times. They made no distinction between themselves and others. When they began to be worshipped, what did they do? They fought against it, right? We're men just as you are. put our pants on one leg at a time, right? We're no different than anyone else. We're simply trying to preach to you the truth. But we see this development of a priesthood. The clergy then began to gradually pattern itself after the Jewish priesthood. Okay, so we see again, even with this departure, we see again Judaizing pattern coming in here. All right, how was the Jewish priesthood set up? How was it set up? All right, what was Aaron? All right, the high priest, the chief priest, the high priest. Aaron was the high priest. Okay. The Levites began to they took care of the tabernacle and then the temple and all the emblems and everything that came therein. The bishop then, as they began to pattern themselves after the Jewish priesthood, the bishop took the place or the position of the high priest. The presbytery or the elders or deacons that served under him, after the priest and then the deacons, as Levites. Okay, so the priest would answer to the bishop or the high priest. The presbytery would answer to the bishop and the deacons, to the presbytery and so forth. And so as would be expected, with an official priesthood came a change in attitude toward the services of the church. In that regard, only authorized priests were allowed to conduct worship services. Okay? And ceremonialism and sacraments began to develop soon thereafter. Now, as we're studying these things, I've got a notebook there full of notes, but these are a very condensed version of The Eternal Kingdom by F.W. Maddox. If you want a recommended reading, if you can get your hands on this book, I would highly recommend it. Very detailed as to the history of the church, gives you the prophecy, some of the stuff that we've already covered, but very, very much more detailed than what we've been able to do in this class. Now, if we wanted to go through this book in particular and look at all these details, we'd probably be here a year or better. To look at everything. But this departure in organization, as these synods were called, they began to... Irenaeus, in 185, there was interest by this time to establish a timeline, if you will, a succession of bishops back all the way back to the apostles. Okay. Now, rightly so, you know, we look at the New Testament and the apostles, with Jesus in heaven, the apostles had the authority, right? Jesus gave them the authority. Whatever they bound on earth would be bound in heaven. Whatever was loosed on earth would be loosed in heaven. All right. The apostles had the authority. Now, with that, they were looked to, of course, as the supreme authority, aside from Christ, on spiritual matters. Now, what they were wanting to do was say that if this bishop, was appointed by this apostle, then he has, that authority was passed on to him, and that's not the case. Why was Titus left in Crete? To appoint elders. Okay? Plural there being, the big thing. Elders and eldership. Okay, and that's one thing that we have to remember, that as we talk to others about this change from New Testament organization to what man has made it today, do you ever find one man ruling over a church in the New Testament? Or is it an eldership collectively? The eldership collectively, it's plural in all cases when we're talking about these men that have been appointed to rule over the kingdom here on earth. Now, Eusebius dedicates a part of his church history to that effort of looking for a succession of bishops all the way back to the apostles. And many of the men that are listed in that early period were nothing more than elders in the New Testament sense. They may have served as the chairman during elders' meetings. I don't know. But there, you know, Catholic Church officials have in recent years revised their list of Roman bishops that, of course, they call popes. In the traditional list, after Peter came Linus, then Cletus, then Clement, and then Anacletus. And it's now admitted by the Roman scholars that Cletus and Anacletus refer to the same man. Right? But there are a couple men there between them. There's also confusion of thought growing out of the tradition that Peter ordained these first three Roman bishops. With Peter's martyrdom in 68, it's difficult to understand how he could ordain Anacletus in 78 and Clement in 90. He was already dead. He was gone. And so it's hard to understand that. Now, we talked about Victor Cyprian in 200 to 258. He worked to give a greater prestige to the bishops. And after 250, the monarchical bishopric was almost universally established. And after that date, there are no clarifying designations. The word bishop in general usage after 250 refers to that monarchical bishop. Okay, so now there's come, by 250, there has come a complete separation of bishop from everything else. And so they're getting heavy into this. As the priesthood began to develop around 150, that distinction began to be made. You begin to see an even bigger departure. Cyprian of Carthage, he did more to establish that hierarchy than any other individual. He followed the thought set forth by Ignatius, and he set apart from the bishop set that apart from the bishop there is no church. Okay. These bishops were the successors of the apostles, Christ overseeing their selection and giving them a special measure of the Holy Spirit. And so, you begin to see this great departure. By the close of the third century then, every congregation of any size, they had a bishop at its head with a group of elders under him, and each province looked to one bishop as greater than the rest with the authority to call councils. The bishops of Rome, Antioch, and Alexandria, They received special recognition because of their apostolic origin. Now, because of this, because of the difference in bishop and everyone else, because of the priesthood developing, you see a growth of sects within them. From about 130 A.D., there was a great number of cults developing within the church itself. And it seems that in every generation, there are those with leadership qualities who are not satisfied to leave the church really as God intended it. Well, that's what we see happening here. They tried to remain in the church, but spread their own influence. And because of that, we see this growth of sects. We see Gnosticism coming about. When you look at the books that John wrote, with the exception of Revelation, so the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, he wrote all those four books, John wrote in direct opposition to Gnosticism. Okay? Why did he write the Gospel of John? What was his reason for that? Why did he record those miracles? So that we may know what? So that we can have confidence in what we know, that we can know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. All right? Why did he write 1 John? If you look at 1 John chapter 5, and I think it's seven, maybe more than that, at least seven different times the word K-N-O-W is used. So why did he write 1 John? So that we may know, that we may have confidence, and what has already been delivered unto us. Same thing with 2 John, same thing with 3 John. He wants us to put Gnosticism. Now, Gnosticism is not a big thing today. There are still some that claim special revelation, as the Gnostics did. But John tells us that we can know, we can have confidence in what has already been delivered to us, right? We can have confidence in that. We know that. What does the word Gnostic mean? Let's spell it for you. G-N-O-S-T-I-C. And then you put ism on the end of it, it becomes Gnostic. To know. That's all it means. Gnostic means to know. Now, what the Gnostics did was they claimed to have special revelation that nobody else had. The apostles had, John, of course, had was an apostle. He preached the gospel. Paul talked to those that he had delivered the gospel unto them, and he begged them, he urged them not to depart from that faith that had been delivered unto them. You have, of course, the other apostles doing the same thing. Now, if they have special revelation, then what do the words of Paul, what do the words of Jude verse 3, what do they mean? What did Jude say in Jude verse 3? What did Jude want to write to them about? He intended to write to them about the common salvation. All right, in other words, just the gospel. But he said, it's needful for me to write to you concerning what? All right, that you earnestly contend for the faith that has been once and for all delivered. Okay? What does that mean, that it's been once and for all delivered? Okay, keeping his commandments. What does it mean, though, that it's been once and for all delivered? That's it. There won't be any more. We don't need anything else. Okay? It's done. Don't need anything else. But here the Gnostics are saying, well, you don't know this. And you can't know that because you don't have special revelation. But I'm enlightened. That was their idea. I've been enlightened. And so John wrote these things concerning that. They believe, Gnostics did, they in general, they believe that matter is evil, that spirit is good, and there is no resurrection of the dead. Christ, they said that Christ did not actually come in the flesh, and that God is in heaven and has no contact with this world. Okay? Now, obviously, you see different aspects of that still being taught today. Not necessarily collectively. So Gnosticism, to a degree, still lives today. This idea of all things being relative, I think you could throw that under this guise of Gnosticism, couldn't you? What's right for you may not be right for me. And so that's kind of the idea, and what's right for me may not be right for you. That's the big thing today, isn't it? You cannot know for sure. But John tells us otherwise. Now they said, and one of the things that has always stuck with me about Gnosticism is that Christ did not come in the flesh. And so when Jesus died, and as he lived here, it was just a figment, if you will. He seemed to suffer on the cross. He seemed to hurt. It seemed that way, but he wasn't actually here in the flesh. Now, how they arrived at that conclusion, I have no idea. They saw something, I'm telling you. But they tried to address the problems of God and providence. That, God is in heaven, he has no contact with this world. In other words, he set things spinning and said, you're on your own. Okay? That was their idea. They addressed the problems of origin and destiny of the universe, concerning Christ. Again, he did not come in the flesh. Intermediary, and redemption, revelation. Finally, because of the writings of John and some of those, such as Polycarp, that were temporary with him, they were finally defeated about 200 A.D. And then they began forming their own societies outside of the church. Now, John, when it came to Gnosticism, it was later in his life when he wrote the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and of course, Revelation was later on in his life. But that's the main reason that he wrote. Now one of his main opponents was a man by the name of Cerinthus. And if you've ever read some of Polycarp's writings, Polycarp gives a bit of an anecdote there. concerning John and Serenthus. John was in a public bath in Ephesus. And John being in that public bath, Serenthus walks in. And if you can imagine, from what Polycarp writes, John at this time is about 90. And he's in this public bath. John runs out of the public bath in Ephesus when Serenthus enters and says, "Let us fly, lest the bath fall in on top of us," because Serenthus, I can't remember the word that he used. Anyway, Serenthus is inside. And so if you can imagine this 90-year-old man just running as hard as he can out because this man that is teaching false doctrine is inside. John, and what does that show us? And that's that can be a funny picture that we get, but what does that show us about the seriousness of those that teach false doctrine? Serious matter, isn't it? It's not something to take lightly. Here's a man running because he is actually fearful that God will cause this bath to fall on top of him. Serious matter. And we see this happening, this departure beginning out of the monarchical bishops, the growth of sects, and so forth. And we're going to stop there. We really get into a good bit of this departure next week. We're going to be talking about millennialism or premillennialism next week. So if you want to look at some things on that, and if you have any questions concerning that, be sure to study up on that for next week. So millennialism or premillennialism is what we'll look at next week as they begin to depart from the faith of the New Testament.